The economy is the classic example where, because of usury, the wealth has been concentrated in so few hands that these people can now buy the politicians and have created a political system that is totally unresponsive to the needs of the overwhelming majority of the American people. And that is causing a reaction. Now, the reaction has to become conscious of what the causes are and come up with a program. That hasn't happened yet. And I think the main roadblock in discourse is this taboo about talking about Jews. You can't address the issue. If you're conservative, you're upset about pornography and abortion and gay marriage. And if you're a liberal, you're upset about the wars in the Middle East, and you're upset about the banking system and the looting of the manufacturing base of the United States. Well, there's one group of people that has all these things in common. And if we can't address that group of people, that group's pernicious influence on our culture, we're never going to get anywhere. There has been precedent. The Catholic Church has had a long track record of dealing with a Jewish minority in a Christian culture. And the name of that precedent is called Sicut Iudaeus Non. And basically, no one has the right to harm the Jew, but on the other hand, the Jew does not have the right to corrupt your culture. That's a modus vivendi, I think, that needs to be brought back, and we need to have that discussion again. And we need to break through these taboos, because so far, we haven't succeeded in making a dent in anything. They can subvert all of these institutions, and we can't even say who is doing the subverting. We can't even address the people who are doing the subverting. It's got to change. You cannot understand history, the history of the West, beginning with the time of Christ to the present day, unless you understand the role of the Jew as the protagonist of anti-logos. When St. John wrote the Gospel in Greek, he had to incorporate Greek philosophy. Greek philosophy became part of the Christian patrimony by the very fact that he wrote in Greek. And so when you say, the first sentence of the St. John's Gospel is, ein arche, ein ha logos. In the beginning, there was logos. In a sense, that's the great metaphysical statement that we have to understand here. We are all creatures of logos. In a sense, logos created us. And it's up to us to find out our situation with vis-a-vis logos. Greek philosophy was integrated into Christianity by the writing of St. John's Gospel. And the word then, in the bigger picture, is reason. Logos is eternal. There's no logos pre-Christ or post-Christ. It's the same logos. It is eternal. And it takes energy to reject logos. And I'm saying that's the job of Jewish leaders, is to keep these people all together rejecting logos. A contemporary example of this, the Coen brothers' film, A Serious Man, is a good example about the tyranny of the rabbi over the Jewish people. But they understand it intuitively, that the rabbi is the enemy of the Jewish people because the rabbi is the roadblock between the Jewish mind and logos. The rabbi is the representative of Talmud, which is the hate speech that keeps Jews separated from logos. In any human context, the people are going to respond to the truth, to reality, and that is logos. The Jew is in a special circumstance. Every Jew has to face this in one way or another. You have to face the fact of, who am I? Do I fit in with the group that they say I belong to? And a lot of people say no. Israel Shamir is one of them. He was in an artillery fight. He was serving in the Israeli army. He thought, wait a minute, who am I working for here? Gilad Atzmon. I could go down the line, all the way back through history. Jews wake up to logos, and either they follow logos to the extent that it is possible, and I'm saying, as a Christian, the fullest extent possible would become to accept baptism and accept Jesus Christ as the Logos incarnate. It's the full, but there are all sorts of intermediary stages. And the crucial thing is, am I going to accept Logos and follow it wherever it goes, the truth? Or am I going to become part of this operation because of the material benefits that accrue from being part of this operation? That's the fundamental question, I think. You cannot understand history, the history of the West, beginning with the time of Christ to the present day, unless you understand the role of the Jew as the protagonist of anti-logos. This is exactly what Friedrich Romek said in his book Der Sinn der Geschichte, The Meaning of History. As soon as you say that there is a meaning in history, this is what the meaning has to be. This is the only possible meaning of history. His book is an attack on positivism, which says there is no meaning in history. It says history is meaningless. And no one believes that, ultimately, I think. Everyone believes that there's a meaning to history, but the only candidate that can fulfill this is the conflict, I think, between Jesus Christ and the Jews. The true meaning of history, because it has expanded now from that small beginning to encompass everything on earth. In a sense, there's not a culture on earth that has not been dragged into this conflict. Take China, for example, that had a culture that existed long before the culture of the West. They were dragged into this via Karl Marx. And now via Milton Friedman, who is the successor, you know, the new architect of the economic system in China. 30-some years after the death of Christ, the revolutionary spirit reaches its fruition, and there's an uprising in Palestine, and they rise up against the Roman conquerors, and it ends in disaster for the Jewish people. The Jewish revolutionaries hold out at Masada, at this mountain redoubt, and they commit suicide. That's not the end, though. 60 years after that, another Jewish revolutionary rises up, and this man's name is Simon Bar Kokhba. He is successful in driving the Romans from Palestine for a certain period of time, and then gradually the Romans cut them off from the sea, and they take over one city at a time, and they basically start to starve them to death, so that they're now holed up in Jerusalem. At this point, a rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, recognizes that the Romans are going to win, so he gets himself smuggled out in a shroud. He goes to the Roman general and says, "I'm a friend of Rome, please grant me one wish. I want to start a school." This is the man who starts Judaism. This is modern Judaism, because what happened in 70 was that the temple was destroyed. You cannot have Judaism without a temple, without a priesthood, and without sacrifice. That all was destroyed then, and so you have to reconstitute Judaism, and so it's this new entity that is younger than Christianity. It's not older than Christianity, and that is what gets started. And at that point, the Jewish people are dispersed throughout the Roman Empire and eventually take up their abode in two main places, which are the enemies of Rome, the successor of the Roman Empire. The enemies of Christendom, which would be Turkey in the east and Spain in the west, and then take up positions of power, generally at this point in anti-Christian countries like Turkey and Moorish Spain. Rome was a culture based on usury. It was capitalism before there was capitalism. And capitalism is state-sponsored usury. So usury was in force in the Roman Empire, and the Jews did not bring it there. The Jews got involved in usury primarily during the Middle Ages as a crucial factor in history. It was the Middle Ages because Christians were forbidden to take usury on loans. And so what you have is a long, complicated process during which the Christians used the Jews. Florence, under Cosimo de' Medici. Florence was a proto-capitalist culture where the oligarchs appropriated surplus value from the laborers, which meant that the laborers were not getting paid a decent wage. So what did Cosimo do? He brought the Jews into Florence. to lend the worker the money that their employers were not paying them. Something similar to what happened in the United States in the 1970s, when the wages started to go down, the credit card appeared, to give the worker the illusion that he had money, which he did not have. So it was that kind of bondage. And the Jew, at this point, learned predatory Jewish financial behavior, which is usury.
With usura hath no man a house of good stone.
1239, when St. Raymond of Peñaforte introduced Nicholas Donan to Pope Gregory IX. And Gregory IX was stunned. He had never heard, the church had never known that there was a Talmud. But the written Talmud had been in existence for 600 years, church didn't know about it. And so he said, this is awful that they would have these type of blasphemies in this book, that the Blessed Mother was a whore, that the father of Jesus Christ was a Roman soldier, that Jesus Christ is now buried up to his ears in excrement, burning excrement in hell. This is cannot be tolerated in a Christian society. The written Talmud had been in existence for 600 years, church didn't know about it. And so he said, this is awful that they would have these type of blasphemies in this book. This cannot be tolerated in a Christian society. So he turned to Raymond of Peñaforte and he said, I want you to put this book on trial. And if it's found guilty, burn it. And I want you to dedicate your order to the conversion of the Jews and the Moors. And what that led then to Thomas Aquinas' Summa Contra Gentiles, Raimondo Martini's Pugeo Fidei Adversus Judeos et Mauros. It was the most successful conversion campaign in the history of the church, I'd have to say, or certainly one of them. They had either converted or they had left and gone to Poland. In a sense, you could say, well, they were forced. There was an element of coercion there. And that's one of the most tragic histories, tragic chapters in the history that I wrote, because what you saw from a theological point of view, the minute the Catholic Church understood that there was such a thing as a Talmud, they worked for the conversion of the Jews because they understood this is a totally wicked ideology. It is an anti-Christian ideology. To understand the crux of the matter, you have to go back to Alexander VI. Which many people consider the worst pope of the history of the papacy. He was a Spaniard. The Renaissance papacy was decadent. It was carnal. It was involved in the accumulation of wealth. And the reform in the church came through the mendicant orders, the Dominicans and the Franciscans. And the great Dominican preacher at this time was Savonarola, who showed up in Florence and denounced sodomy and usury, just as Dante had denounced sodomy and usury in Florence 200 years before that. The papacy had to respond, and the papacy, because Savonarola hated the papacy and because he was hoping that the King of France would come in and depose the Pope, Alexander VI turned on Savonarola and basically connived in his death. He was murdered by the citizens of Florence. I think that was the crucial turning point. The church, the papacy, should have joined in with this reform. They should have stopped usury dead in its tracks at this point. Because they did not, the next time the church did not stop being corrupt. And the next time the protest came, it was Luther. And this time, it was not going to be an intra-jurist battle. because the aristocracy saw its chance to steal church property and confer on Luther the status of state church in exchange. And that, once that happened, the church's police power was broken, and that began the rise of capitalism, what we call capitalism now, which is basically state-sponsored usury.
With usura, sin against nature, is thy bread evermore of stale rags.
There was this, still this corruption in the papacy. There was, there's no question about it. You also had the rise of German nationalism at this time. There were people who felt that gold, remember, gold is money. That's the only source of wealth. Gold is pouring out of Germany into Rome, and they're depleting. You also had a group of people, the minor aristocracy. Ulrich von Hutten was one of the leaders of the Reformation. It's the minor aristocracy that's being frozen out of the picture by people like the Fugger family, the bankers. The aristocracy is bound up with land, and you've got all these guys who are paying you in bushels of grain, and you need money, and you're frozen out of the money operation, and the leadership is being taken over by these banking families in Augsburg, like the Fuggers. And so you've been disenfranchised, and that becomes a disenfranchised aristocracy is the best, probably the best revolutionary cadre you can have, and that's precisely what Ulrich von Hutten was. So you add that to Luther situation, which is exactly the situation with the Hussites, of monks who were carnal. Zelivsky in Defenestration of Prague, a monk like Luther, a monk like Thomas Münzer, these were people who hated the evangelical councils. They didn't want to live that way anymore. They were sick of celibacy, sick of fasting, all this type of stuff. The classical world knew about usury, and all of the leaders, the intellectual leaders of the classical world, whether the Hebrew writers or the Greeks, knew that it was toxic and you had to prohibit it.
The most hated, and with the greatest reason, is usury, which makes a gain out of money itself and not from the natural object of it. For money was intended to be used in exchange, but not to increase at interest. And this term, interest, which means the birth of money from money, is applied to the breeding of money, because the offspring resembles the parent. Wherefore, of all modes of getting wealth, this is the most unnatural. Aristotle, 350 BC.
But the empires all practiced usury, and the Roman Empire was the classic instance of a usurious empire. A usury then concentrated wealth into fewer and fewer hands. It reduced workers to slaves that would work on huge agricultural operations called latifundia, and it indirectly brought about the collapse of the Roman Empire. Christianity arose to fill the gap left by the collapse of the Roman Empire. And oftentimes they simply took over the whatever was left of the mechanism of the Roman Empire. And so diocese is a word that's a Roman designation of an administrative unit. And it's obviously a Catholic designation of a unit. But the difference was that Christianity understood the value of labor in a way that no usury empire can, because there are fundamentally two choices. Either you think that money can copulate, then that's all you need, because you can just put two coins together and they will copulate and you'll end up with three coins. If you don't believe that, then you have to accept the premise that labor is the source of value. And this is precisely what the church did. The people who saved civilization were the Benedictines, largely, the Benedictine monasteries, and their motto was Ora et Labora. And for the first time in human history, you had a culture that honored labor. And so for 1,000 years, you had a labor-based economy where the monastery would store up the values that were acquired by labor and concentrate them and put them to social use. This was unprecedented. It's in a sense a unique period of history, because it was the period of history where the Catholic Church had hegemony over the culture, total hegemony. This was also a period during which economic exchange almost went out, almost ceased. And in some areas, there was basically not a monetary economy. So in places like Venice, it still was a monetary economy, never stopped being that. But in the interior of places like the Holy Roman Empire, you had an economy where you owed your lord labor, or the produce of your labor.